It is Saturday morning. It's the Saturday morning author interview. A few of you have said you're interested in these things. And so I did another one. I do them as often as I can, whenever the publicists make them available. This one is with a guy named Ryan Lovelace, who is the author of the new book, Search and Destroy, Inside the Campaign Against Brett Kavanaugh. This is out now. You can order it on Amazon, and I urge you to do that because the more of you who order these books, the more authors I'm going to get. So without delaying this any further, Ryan Lovelace. Ryan, first of all, welcome. Thank you for taking the time today. What do we not know about what we saw go down in those Kavanaugh hearings?
Well, I think the two biggest questions that were left unanswered coming out of those hearings were the why and the how. You know, if you look back to Christine Blasey Ford's allegations at this time last year, last fall, she said she couldn't exactly remember when the alleged sexual assault happened. She couldn't say precisely where it happened. And the only person that could ever say what happened was Christine Blasey Ford. No one else ever corroborated it. Anyone else she pointed to either said it didn't happen or they didn't know anything about it. So when her reason why for doing all this was all along her civic duty. She testified that it was her civic duty, and her lawyers said that Christine Blasey Ford was ambivalent. And so then as I investigated that in Search and Destroy, really what I discovered was that there are other explanations as well. One of which, coming from Deborah Katz, Christine Blasey Ford's attorney, was that Christine Blasey Ford was motivated in part by Roe versus Wade, and in particular, protecting the legalized right to obtain an abortion.
So she, under that theory, she felt she had to step up and kill Kavanaugh's nomination or else lose Roe v. Wade.
Based upon her interpretation of what Judge Kavanaugh would do, yes, yes. And that's what Deborah Katz is saying. You know, she says that it was all about putting an asterisk next to Judge Kavanaugh's name. And I think that's really important to keep in mind, because in the first 2 years of the Trump administration, with Justice Gorsuch's nomination, the left said he sits in the stolen seat that belongs to Merrick Garland, President Obama's selection that was rejected by the Senate. And he sits, and then with Judge Kavanaugh, there has to be an asterisk next to his name associated with the Me Too environment. There has to be an asterisk. And both of those things are about undermining the legitimacy and authority of the court. And if the left can successfully do that, they can push other parts of their agenda that are so important, too.
Did Christine Blasey Ford actually believe that Kavanaugh would upset Roe v. Wade, or just that there was a possibility he would?
I think that's a very important question, and it's hard to know without talking to her directly. And unfortunately, she's never faced an adversarial question. You know, that was one of the things that was so interesting to me watching this. It's a question of whether or not you believe her lawyer, if what Deborah Katz has said is true. And in watching the hearings unfold last September, Christine Blasey Ford only ever faced sympathetic questions from Democrats and from Rachel Mitchell, the sex crimes prosecutor who asked questions on behalf of Republicans. When Republicans talked to me for this book, Search and Destroy, about how they stayed together and how they didn't break ranks, they point to Michael Avenatti's antics as one particular thing that made it easier. And if you look at the way he brought forward his accuser, Julie Swetnick, and how her allegations crumbled, I think it shows why Christine Blasey Ford succeeded where Julie Swetnick failed. Michael Avenatti put his client on television, on national television, opposite an adversarial investigative reporter who didn't feel the pressure to adopt the narrative of believed woman. She was able to ask questions without that same pressure, and Julie Swetnick was alone by herself. Christine Blasey Ford only ever appeared on national television flanked by her lawyers and always facing sympathetic questions.
Do you think that Christine Blasey Ford came close to getting away with it?
I think she came very close to successfully canceling Kavanaugh's nomination. And it was really one of those things that could only have happened in the current environment that we're in. You know, in listening to Deborah Katz, her attorney, Christine Blasey Ford's attorney, and looking through her private emails to Senate Democrats and Senate Republicans and watching all of her speeches, one of the things that I saw her say that was most remarkable to me was that this is in these kinds of cases, in cases that are never going to reach a courtroom, you can't just look to the law. You can't just look to the wall. You need a press strategy, a legislative strategy, and you need to utilize organized forces in the nonprofit realm, an organized collective push to accomplish your client's agenda, which in this case was a political agenda about Roe versus Wade.
I'm speaking with Ryan Lovelace, author of the new book, Search and Destroy, Inside the Campaign Against Brett Kavanaugh, this episode now a year ago. So did Christine, I mean, the way you went at this and in your research, did she think that putting up a story that couldn't and wouldn't be verified or corroborated was going to pass muster?
I think her attorneys understood precisely how to present her story so that it wouldn't ever reach the stage where it needed to pass muster. That's one of those things that's completely different about Judge Kavanaugh's nomination, now Justice Kavanaugh, than any of the Supreme Court justices that came before him. You know, when Justice Thomas was nominated and faced the Anita Hill hearings, there was, talk radio, but there wasn't the same online new media and social media environment that exists today. And if we look back to how Christine Blasey Ford first approached this whole allegation situation, she went through an encrypted app and contacted the Washington Post multiple times. And I've published those encrypted messages in my book in the back of it in full so people can read it for themselves. But what we saw unfold then was the Post wasn't interested in what she had to say. And later, after hooking up with an attorney, then we saw the allegation alleging an incident, as it was described this week, literally a year ago, in The Intercept, a blog on the internet. And then from there, Dianne Feinstein, the senator from California, confirmed it. And once she confirmed that she had something, no one in my line of work in the national press bothered looking into the truth of the matter to see whether or not the allegation passed muster. It was all about, does this help him? Does this hurt him? How does it affect him? And it soon spread on cable news.
Why do you think that the media was so willing to believe her story without checking it?
Well, I think there are a few reasons. The first of which is in watching the way this spread, you know, the online and new media is susceptible to this trading up the chain effect where nonsense can become headline news just by the way in which it spreads online, kind of what I was just describing. But I think also there's another big reason here, which is kind of a symptom of the Me Too environment we're in. You know, with Christine Blasey Ford's allegation, anyone that bothered asking any kind of skeptical questions outside of, you know, where this was being actually debated in the Senate were told that was improper. You're supposed to believe the woman, not supposed to question the woman or ask questions about what happened, but you're supposed to believe the woman. And what that really did was I think it made so many in the press believe, well, the truth is never really knowable here. And at the moment which it becomes he said, she said, because people refuse to actually ask the questions necessary to get to the truth, then I think that's why the press partially fell down on the job.
If I can take a little detour here, what do you think the effect on Brett Kavanaugh was?
Well, I think there might have been a few different effects. You know, obviously, it very much affected his family personally, as he testified to when he came forward after Christine Blasey Ford in the hearing last year. You know, I think we saw a very emotional response at that time, which was different from what we had seen him state publicly before and all the rest of that. In terms of whether or not it actually affected, his jurisprudence or anything like that, I'm not sure there's really any indication of that. You know, one of the things that I think is so important to keep in mind is he's very well familiar with so many of his opponents and critics on the left, having been, you know, a big law partner at some of the biggest law firms in town, a Supreme Court law clerk, a judge on a court of appeals in D.C. for a decade, having worked in the White House on judicial nominations himself, including for Chief Justice John Roberts. I think he perhaps better understood the kind of vitriol he might be facing than any other Supreme Court justice sitting on the court now during their nomination process. But I'm not sure even he could have expected precisely what unfolded.
Do you have any insight into what occurred between the interview he did with Martha McCallum, which seemed to be very buttoned up and tight, if you will, and then going into the hearing and just exploding, and I think righteously exploding, but something changed almost overnight.
I do, yeah. And one of the things that I report out in Search and Destroy is about how he prepared for that hearing. And, you know, earlier and before the hearing, which happened on a Thursday, there were moots, which are mock trials whereby his team was preparing him for the kinds of questions he would face. And as some of those questions became more personal, things about his sex life or lack thereof from his teenage years started to leak out to folks like me in the press. Those in the White House that were organizing those, you know, mock sessions made them much smaller. And one of the things I found was 2 days before his actual hearing, he had a smaller meeting in then White House counsel Don McGahn's office. And among the people that were there were his personal attorney, Don McGahn, Mark Paoletta, who was counsel formerly to Vice President Pence and had worked on the preparation of Justice Thomas's hearings many years ago, and then a lawyer from DOJ. And one of the things that he, then Judge Kavanaugh, now Justice Kavanaugh, took from those meetings was to approach that hearing in a way where his adversary was the committee, not the woman beside him who was trying to make allegations against him, but to approach it as adversarial against the committee. And I think that's one of the reasons why we heard him sort of call out to this being a national disgrace, which is a similar phrase that Justice Thomas had used. And then, of course, him saying to the committee, you've replaced advice and consent with search and destroy. You know, I went into this expecting the advice and consent process to play out as it had before. I expected it to be bruising, but at the end of the day, I expected it would work in a way similar to how the Senate rejected Merrick Garland and accepted Justice Gorsuch. But really, you know, in reporting this out, I began to see precisely what then Justice Kavanaugh was talking about, that I think so many folks who didn't follow the ins and outs and weren't able to kind of see all the inside information that I was able to uncover in this book didn't see at the time.
What are your insights into Dianne Feinstein?
Well, there's one really big one that I think is important in this book that I'd like to communicate to folks, which is about how the letter moved, Christine Blasey Ford's letter about the private allegation. For the longest time, people were asking, you know, why did she sit on it? Why didn't she share it? And one of the things I uncovered was Christine Blasey Ford's attorney's private letter to Senator Feinstein's staff, directing them when to share the letter with Republicans and the full committee. And at the point at which she did that, Deborah Katz sort of calling the shot there and Feinstein staff deferring to an outside lawyer who doesn't work for the government, she had already gone to the press. Deborah Katz had already been on cable news on CNN and on other television networks, and Christine Blasey Ford had out herself in the Post. In fact, Deborah Katz had also contacted me, you know, interacted with me, we went back and forth with messages and things, you know, in the run-up to that because I was a member of the press. And so when I spotted that and I saw that she had come to me and others in the press before going to the Judiciary Committee, it raised some real questions about what the motivation was there. And it also helped shed some light on how that letter moved around Washington.
What do you think Dianne Feinstein's motivation was? Was it the same as Christine Blasey Ford? She was just worried about Roe and was willing to do anything to stop someone who might overturn Roe?
I think it's difficult to know. And one of the ways in which I tried to find that out was by listening to what Senator Feinstein's lawyers have been saying in private. And one of the things Senator Feinstein's lawyers have been talking about was the thing that they most appreciate about this process was talking to the press. So I'm not quite so sure whether Senator Feinstein was brought into sort of the organized push on the left from the outside the political process until later on, or when exactly she might have had the motivation to get involved in this way. I really do think part of what happened this time that didn't happen last time with then Judge Gorsuch has to do with the political tools available to the left. You know, they employed the first partisan filibuster of a Supreme Court nominee against Gorsuch. And when Republicans nuked that filibuster and removed that weapon, things got much more personal, much more fast. And it was out of Feinstein's hands by that point.
What about Lindsey Graham? Was that from the heart or was that theatrics?
I think it was clearly from the heart. You know, one of the things that he said in that is so memorable was him sort of looking down the dais and saying to his Democratic colleagues, you know, tell Elena and Sonia I said hello, in reference to Justices Sotomayor and Kagan, who were picked by President Obama, because he had approached it differently. And he was kind of foreshadowing when he would become Judiciary Committee chairman, which he is now, that things would proceed differently. I think he understood kind of the moment that they were in at that time. And I think he was probably frustrated from, you know, everything that had been going on. So I think that was genuine from frustration from everything I've been able to report out.
Did you discover any guilty consciences on the committee?
I don't know that I would describe any of the consciences really as guilty. I think so many folks on the left that were, you know, particularly up in arms about all of this, were very motivated. And we saw so many of them launch presidential campaigns not soon thereafter all of this sort of ended. And, you know, much of the theatrics that went on last fall around this time, around these hearings, you know, it really was organized in a way that wasn't discoverable to the public at the time. You know, as a reporter covering the hearings, even the first set of hearings, the beginning of the month of September, before Christine Blasey Ford came forward, one of the things that folks might remember is protesters standing up and screaming and trying to prevent them from even happening. Every time one of those protesters was hauled out by Capitol Police, a PR firm titled Megaphone Strategies would contact me as a reporter and tell me how many people had been arrested and would I like to talk to this celebrity protesters arrested actress Piper Bravo or a thing like that, because it was all part of trying to make this appear as organized chaos when in reality it was something that was created specifically for this moment. And I think because there was such a vested and concerted interest in doing this last fall, I don't think there's too many on the left that were willing to do that have, you know, publicly in any way, revealed any kind of guilty conscience.
What do you think of Michael Avenatti's present situation?
Well, beyond even the legal trouble that he's in now, which seems to be insurmountable, there's still a few criminal referrals regarding his involvement in this process and what he and his client, Julie Swetnick, alleged. That's still under review by the Justice Department. And I'll be interested to see whether that enters into, you know, all of the years that he's facing for the other charges that he's facing.
It richly deserved, if I may add a comment. So another thing I'm curious about, because you might have some insight here. So what has this year been for Brett Kavanaugh?
Well, I think it's really been an exercise in the unexpected. You know, I think he probably had some idea of what he was facing just from his long tenure in Washington and his knowledge of the political system and the knowledge of judicial nominations that other folks didn't. But really, I think, you know, he perhaps wasn't expecting this orchestrated and large-scale campaign. He's only spoken publicly once thus far out at a event at the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals with Justice Kennedy. And at the time, one of the things that he was saying was weighing on his mind was, what would Justice Kennedy do when he's sitting down to write an opinion? That's something that he thinks to. But I think we're going to get a better insight into exactly what he's thinking now and his reflections on what's happening now next month in October. That's the first time he's going to be speaking kind of at length in public at a Federalist Society annual event in Washington, D.C. He's scheduled to. And I think we might have a better idea then of precisely what's been going on in his life since then, since last September.
What was your insight into what Anthony Kennedy thought about this circus?
Well, I don't think he certainly expected it. You know, one of the things that my reporting showed going back to the nomination of Judge Kavanaugh was obviously Kavanaugh having been a clerk to Justice Kennedy, having that personal relationship and the rest of it did make a difference both in President Trump's eyes and in Justice Kennedy's. But I'm not sure whether or not he truthfully expected all of this would have unfolded. And I think, you know, judges across the board didn't. One of the things that I wanted to do in reporting Search and Destroy, too, was to see whether or not any of the judges on President Trump's shortlist removed themselves from it in the aftermath of all of this. And to my knowledge in reporting, no one has removed themselves specifically because of this event in the aftermath of all of this. But I do think there's signs that suggest judges that are on that shortlist understand they're going to be attacked in a political way. And even when they have not in the past bothered to give any consideration toward politics and how to approach a particular matter in public because of it, I think they're now aware of just precisely how they would be attacked if they were nominated or take a different position in the future.
Well, let me turn to one other thing that might be outside the purview of your book, but I'm curious, considering your expertise, what you think. Ruth Bader Ginsburg has had a couple little bouts with cancer recently. She seems to be determined to hang on till the end of her life. But that seems like it's going to be the next opportunity for Donald Trump to make a nomination to the court. What do you think about that situation?
Well, I think there's going to be an interesting question of when a vacancy comes from, her exit from the court. I think you're right. I don't think she's going to voluntarily leave before President Trump leaves the White House. If she involuntarily leaves before the 2020 election, things are only going to get much crazier and worse, I think, even than we can imagine right now. You know, President Trump has talked about wanting to pick a woman, perhaps to replace a woman. And I think because of how beloved Justice Ginsburg is by the left, and because of her willingness to speak on politics, about legislation she'd like to see, about amendments to the Constitution she'd like to see, and all of those sorts of things, if someone who is so beloved by the political left is replaced by a judge, in the mold of the kind that President Trump has picked thus far, an originalist and textualist that just looks at the Constitution, I think you could see a completely apoplectic left, unlike what we've even seen thus far.
Well, all right, let me suggest a name, Amy Coney Barrett, who it would be a woman. She is a circuit judge, is on the Court of Appeals in the Seventh Circuit, a professor of law at Notre Dame. She's been on the short list before. That is just exactly the kind of person that would send the left into apoplexy, is she not?
She is. And I really think one of the things that might set the left off even more with Judge Barrett is something that's arisen since her nomination. You know, so many folks remember Senator Feinstein saying the dogma lives loudly within you and kind of questioning her Catholic faith and how that would affect her judging. But since she's joined that court, she's authored some really interesting opinions. And I think she recognizes how she might be attacked. She's done some private events here in Washington at a big law firm, Jones Day, with her Notre Dame colleagues. And she also spoke at an event at Hillsdale here in D.C. And when I heard her speak at the Hillsdale event in D.C., I was interested in how much she focused on a dissent she authored in the Second Amendment case, in particular, where she wrote separately from her colleagues to say that in certain circumstances, a felon should be able to own a firearm. And she went at length to explain the kind of deliberative process she and her law clerks took to finding the originalist interpretation of things. But I think she knew that that was going to be an opinion that would definitely raise the hackles of some on the left. And she wanted to sort of get out in front of it and explain it. And kind of reporting this out, I've seen how those judges are sort of trying to explain things better and explain things in public in ways to people that, don't sit down and read through federal appellate court opinions because they know the left is going to try to demagogue and demonize it.
Does the left have any opportunity? And by this, of course, I mean the left in the Senate. Have an opportunity to, is there any way, while Donald Trump is president, that they can dilute the court by adding more seats to try to keep some kind of representation of liberal judges?
I think so long as President Trump is indeed president, I think it would be difficult for them to do that. I think if they tip the balance of the Senate and then change the White House, they may be able to accomplish it at that point. But I still think after that point, we might begin to see whether or not the entire left is fully on board with this. You know, the one big group behind that whole orchestrated and organized push to expand the court is a Demand Justice. It's a dark money far left group that formed after Justice Kennedy, actually a few days before Justice Kennedy retired, but after Justice Gorsuch's confirmation. And they went after Judge Kavanaugh hard, and they said they plan to spend $5 million no matter who was picked. They're now out there running ads against Democratic candidates across the country, trying to push them further to the left on this issue. You know, they ran a $15,000 ad campaign in New Hampshire against Senator Michael Bennet, who is running for president, but was polling at 0%. So they're going after their own and trying to push them as far to the left as possible to adopt this agenda of expanding the court, diluting the vote of President Trump's pick, and at the same time working to delegitimize anyone who Trump has nominated or will nominate.
So what is your take on how John Roberts, the Chief Justice, is looking at all of this, and whether he is, in fact, drifting a little bit to the left to maintain a balance on the court?
My sense is always that Chief Justice John Roberts has been an institutionalist. He's very much concerned with the legacy of the court, with how it's perceived publicly, and the kind of the public faith and confidence in it. So I know that he's watching those sorts of things closely. Whether or not there's a new swing vote that is going to really emerge on the court, or a new block of justices that could form to settle some issues that didn't exist in the past when Justice Scalia and Justice Kennedy sat together in the court, I think is going to be something that takes a few more terms to really suss out. You know, we've just kind of gotten through two justices in 2 years. If there's another vacancy, I'm not sure whether we'll really have enough information to figure out precisely how the Chief Justice is going to rule in all sorts of different circumstances. But I think it's something that he watches very closely and he's very concerned with.
I'm speaking with Ryan Lovelace, author of the new book, Search and Destroy, Inside the Campaign Against Brett Kavanaugh. So just to wrap it up, is the campaign against Kavanaugh, what we all saw play out in the open, and now you've pulled back the curtain on some of it, is this the template? Is this what we can expect when anybody is a nomination, nominee?
It is. It really is. It's all about litigating these things in the course of public opinion rather than in a court of law, an actual courtroom, or anything like that. And I think it's the template that the left has kind of crafted over time. Some folks go back to Judge Bork's nomination. Some people go back to Justice Thomas's. But really, this is born of a new moment. It's in the Me Too environment, and it's all about utilizing the different forces that exist today that hadn't before. And the left came very close to taking down Judge Kavanaugh. And I think if we see another nominee, it wouldn't surprise me in the slightest if many of the same actors try to do many of the same things.
But wait a minute. Christine Blasey Ford was caught blatantly lying, and Julie Swetnick was caught blatantly lying. Doesn't that embarrass these people who relied on them?
I don't think so. You know, in looking at what they've said since the hearings and all the events of last summer, they've continued to collect awards. They continue. Christine Blasey Ford has continued to maintain that, you know, she's ambivalent about all of this, and she wasn't really part of this, you know, orchestrated push. But there's no suggestion that there's, you know, from them that they feel in any way ashamed by anything that's gone on at all.
I noticed a story. Perhaps it came from you. I didn't see the reporter or whoever reported it, that Christine Blasey Ford's father was a supporter of Kavanaugh.
Yes, I'd seen that too. That did not come from me. That was something, though, that I had heard in advance of writing my book. And there's a few other things of that ilk that are kind of coming from the, you know, Bethesda area community that both Christine Blasey Ford and Brett Kavanaugh hail from. You know, one of the reasons why I didn't include that sort of thing in my book was because of the kind of information that I felt was necessary to share with the readers to confirm it. You know, in my book, one of the things that I tried to do was provide information and not affirmation. So when I'm quoting from those encrypted messages that I mentioned, or private emails that I was discussing from Deborah Katz, Christine Blasey Ford's attorney, to Senate Democrats, I then put those things in full in the back so people can read through it themselves and see that it's not being taken out of context or spinning them in any way. I didn't think with that particular tidbit of news that was something that I would be able to do given the kind of confirmation I was able to get, and so I didn't include that in that way. But I know that we've had reporting for some time about the differences between her Christine Blasey Ford's family's political beliefs and her own, and it'll be interesting to see what more comes out as we get closer to the anniversary of the hearings and of all of this.
Yeah, there's one last thing I wanted to ask you. I'm always thinking of one last thing. I'm sorry to do that to you. But Brett Kavanaugh said in that day when he went volcanic that I'll never be able to coach my daughter's basketball teams again. Is that how it worked out?
Well, I think he has in some ways been able to return to some of the things that he was doing before the hearings. You know, we've seen him publicly here in town still participate with Catholic Charities in some ways, running in marathons. So he is making public appearances, but not quite so many and not as much as he was able to before this whole episode. And I think part of that is, you know, he understands Washington. Having worked here in nearly every branch of government and lived here for such a long time, I think he knows where to go to be noticed in town and where he wants to go when he doesn't want to be noticed in town. And so I think for the most part, he's laid low this first year. And so I think he understands kind of the unusual political environment we're in. And whether or not he's really going to be able to return to that, or whether the left has successfully marked him with an asterisk, as they say they want to, is something that's going to be kind of only able to be determined after, I think, more time has passed.
The new book is Search and Destroy, Inside the Campaign Against Brett Kavanaugh. The author is Ryan Lovelace. He was a reporter with the Washington Examiner. And so where are you now?
I am at the National Law Journal, American Lawyer and American Lawyer Media, and I'm the D.C. Business of Law reporter there.
Well, okay. Well, congratulations on the book and very good luck with it. And thank you for taking the time today. I really appreciate it. I'm sure my listeners are going to enjoy this. A half an hour podcast. I'm looking at the time right now. A half an hour podcast. They like these things. And I've gotten quite a few messages from my subscribers saying that when I do put out these interviews with authors, they go and buy the book. So best of luck to you.
Well, thanks so much. That's great to hear. I really appreciate that.
All right.